Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we'll have a roundtable discussion about what's going on in the world of Wisconsin wildlife, natural resources, nature, outdoors recreation. We can talk about all kinds of things with our three guests today. With me by phone, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. Dean, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Larry. Happy to be here.
Yeah, great to have you back. Pat Durkin, freelance writer, editor, and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, great to have you along.
Thanks, Larry.
And Tim Isley with me in the studio. Tim's a full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. And Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. Wonderful to be here.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to have you here. We have a lot of topics to talk about today. And as you listen, we'd certainly love to have you join in the conversation with your own concerns, questions, comments. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'd certainly love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about chronic wasting disease in Wisconsin, or maybe Lyme disease? Is that putting a dent in your summer plans? What other nature or wildlife issues are on your mind? Please feel free to join in. And Pat, you had a piece that you wrote, I think it was, well, recently anyway, the number of Wisconsin deer testing positive for CWD, that it reached a record high in 2016. Is the DNR doing enough to acknowledge, or are we as a, just sort of as a society here in Wisconsin, doing enough to acknowledge the danger? Maybe you could talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I think it was back in March, or maybe early April, the final totals came in for the 2016 testing year, and the number of deer tested that was positive this year was nearly 450. So that was a record high by, oh gosh, like I think 25% higher over the previous high. And I guess that the thing I keep talking about with people is that we're testing fewer deer than we have historically, and yet we're getting still record numbers of deer testing positive. And I think people are concerned about it very much so. I mean, when I go out and talk to different, you know, civic groups, typically they're very heavily non-hunters. But they've heard just enough about CWD, and they've heard just enough about the fact that our DNR isn't really publicizing it very much, that I sense that they are getting a little bit tired of how little information is getting out there and how aggressively the state is not handling this. And, you know, I don't think there's any magic solution to CWD, but I think what's really tough about the whole thing is we're not doing a whole lot to learn about it and try different things that might you know, give us some better understanding of what kind of threats we're facing from this disease.
Yeah. I turn for a minute to Dean Bortz. Dean, what are your thoughts about it? What are you hearing from your readers and so forth?
Well, there's no question that everybody's concerned about CWD, and not just CWD, but disease in general. I mean, we have we don't have bovine TB in the state, but I mean, states around us have had it, and you know, so it isn't restricted. Concern isn't restricted to just CWD, but diseases just in general. People are aware of it now. You know, I guess I'd say their awareness is heightened to disease possibilities now, and with CWD being the first and foremost in their mind, they would definitely like to. Well, I don't know if we can say that there's ever going to be a cure for it, but they'd definitely like to get us working towards a cure or control or some way to manage the disease. Whether that's going to be possible or not, I don't know. But like Patrick said, if there's a way that we could do a little more in that direction, I think it would certainly be a good move.
Yeah. Ann in Dodgeville has a question relating to that. Let's just go there. Ann, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking my call. I was told by a local hunter that the DNR has a protocol for dressing a deer that focuses on a careful approach, which then makes it safe to eat the meat, without a chronic wasting disease test. And I'm wondering, is that true? And is there, because people around here don't like to get the deer tested.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Patrick, we'll go to you first.
Yeah. Like a lot of things, that you know, it's the question, the answer is complicated. But in a to say yes or no, I'd say no. That's not true. CWD, the prions that cause CWD, or we think causes it, they've been found throughout the deer. Now, I mean, they concentrate in spinal fluids and the different lymph nodes, but they found it now in the meat. It's in smaller amounts, you know, but for anyone to think they're somehow dodging a bullet because they're cleaning the deer carefully and not cutting through the spine with their knife and these kind of things and not eating, you know, because you'll find that the prions concentrated in things like the eyes, things we typically don't eat. So, yeah, you can reduce the chance that you're going to be cutting into this stuff and spreading it onto the meat, but not cutting through the spinal column. And those kind of things, and dressing it out yourself, and just doing basically fillet the meat off the bone is the safest way to do it. But that's still no guarantee. And I think that what people should be concerned about is that there's been just because we haven't found CWD to jump the species barrier, doesn't mean it never will. I mean, I really kind of go back to this fact that you know for years in Europe, people were told that. Bovine, you know, that
spongiform.
I can never pronounce the big scientific word, but basically the mad cow disease. They were told for years that you cannot get that from eating beef, and people would go on TV and show how brave they were by eating beef, you know, on TV. Well, then eventually it turns out that yeah, some people, we don't quite know why, but some people were susceptible and started getting, you know, the human version of mad cow disease, and until we can really say with certainty that it cannot jump the species barrier, I just don't think we should be encouraging people to think that there's somehow a safe way to eat venison without getting the stuff tested. And even then, the test does not necessarily guarantee that that's a food safety item. I mean, it gives you a lot more certainty than not getting it tested, but it's still no guarantee.
There we go. Tim Isley, you want to add in here?
Sure, Larry. I definitely agree. I think after I've done some interviews with Dr. Mike Samuel and also Tom Haugie recently, the retired wildlife director at the DNR, and definitely people should have their meat tested. And especially it used to be thought that the prion was just in the nervous system, but they have found CWD prions in the meat. So I think for somebody not to have their meat tested is really very, very short-sighted. I definitely would have it tested. The other thing that in CWD, number one, of course, there's the concern over the disease and health implications, both to the herd and possible, as Pat mentioned, you know, you never know in the future what could happen as far as humans. But the other thing, the important thing, is what this is doing to the deer herd. And, you know, this could really decimate the deer herd eventually if this increases like that. And the thing is that the deer herd and deer hunting to Wisconsin, Dr. Mike Samuel, when he testified in front of the CWD response committee earlier this year, he made the analogies, which I thought was really good, that just like the football team is to the UW athletic department, they fund it. They provide the money for that whole athletic department. Basically, they operate. Deer hunting is to the Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Management Program. So it's so important to have the deer hunters out there and the licensed sales, which support so many of the wildlife management programs. So this is a very major thing in the state of Wisconsin, as well as an economic thing for the local towns and tourism. So this is really important, and I think CWD has got to be taken very seriously.
Yeah. And thanks for calling. Appreciate it. And let's take one more relating to CWD at this moment, and certainly we'll get back to it, but there are other issues we want to bring up as well. Chris in Oshkosh, thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking a call. I guess the question I have is, okay, we know or are pretty confident that prions carrying the disease, and I find the outbreaks are pretty widespread, so I don't think the deer are actually spreading the disease. And my question is, there's guys doing food plots And also, even with the General Agriculture Department, now if the prions are coming up through the plant life, is anybody testing these seeds, if there's any seeds coming from out of state or even in state, when these guys are putting out food plots, are the seeds already infected with prions, or are these seeds treated so we don't have that issue? And if not, why not? And maybe that would solve some of the spread problems. I mean, if it's coming up through the plant life and the animals are consuming it, I don't think it's just a baiting issue. I think it's a plant issue. And goose eats the grass and then carries it 20 miles and craps all over, and now we got it there.
I want to, Pat, I'll just go back to you first. I don't think there's any research that shows that those prions can come up through the plant life. But I'm honestly not sure.
You're wrong on that.
All right, I'm wrong on that.
You're wrong on that. Yeah, there is some pretty good research that shows these prions can come up through the root systems. But I guess to address the listener's question is, I mean, it'd be nice if we could just say that the only thing we have to worry about here is the seeds and the food plot. But I think when you're dealing with a state like Wisconsin that's so heavily agriculture, I mean, crops, just, you know, huge, miles upon miles of crops, I think to sit there and make any kind of comparison about worrying about seeds, well, if you're worried about seeds being a source for spreading CWD, well, how do you deal with our huge agricultural industry? And that's a much bigger concern. I mean, you look at any field out there, there's alfalfa, corn, potatoes, you name it, it's possible that that stuff is coming up through the plant. But we really don't know for certain how this disease is being spread. That's why, you know, I think if you're going to do things like one little area and think you're going to address this issue, you're probably wrong. But, you know, it's very likely that the disease is spread animal to animal through some kind of direct contact, whether it's through the animal itself and their saliva, their feces, or urine. We don't know. It's one of those questions you wish we were putting some money into the research to really try to figure out how is this disease being spread.
Yeah.
But also, I think that came up during the CWD response committee when they had their meetings earlier this year, that there was concern that this could affect Wisconsin agriculture because CWD can be taken up by certain plants. If that's the case, and if Wisconsin is shipping some of its agricultural products, some of the things growing in our fields to other states, there may be some concerns there that people may say, oh, wait a minute, are we going to accept that? So there is more research definitely needed. Food plots, though, in general, if somebody who's planting a food plot, that spreads deer out a whole field. The problem is when you've got a source such as in feeding or baiting, and they're coming nose to nose and with saliva, that's where you've got the much better chance of spread, I think. So that's the concern.
Yeah. All right. Thanks again for that question. Visiting today with three outdoor communicators, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance editor and writer, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. I'm Larry Mueller. Jason Butler, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn's guest talks about how some media outlets are pushing pro- and anti-Trump conspiracy theories to whip up intrigue and outreach. That's at 2 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at the world of natural resources here in Wisconsin with our three guests, Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley. And I want to go to Matt in Madison next. Matt, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes. Good morning, Larry. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. I want to say thank you for your programs. They're excellent. And Pat Durkin, I read your columns, and welcome to the other guests. The comment I have is the current federal and state administrations do not take environmental issues seriously. President Trump's current proposed budget, I just read it in the Wisconsin State Journal this morning, they want to cut the Environmental Protection Agency by 31.4%. It's the largest cut of any government program. At the state level, as you know, the governor wants to eliminate funding for the Wisconsin Natural Resources Magazine, and they don't fully staff the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources with their scientists, etc., nor do they enforce the laws fully. And I just wanted to point that out to you probably know that, and but I just wanted to bring it to your attention for your listeners.
All right. Well, we can get some comments. Dean Bortz, let's go to you first.
Okay, Larry. Wow, where do we start with that one? There's a lot of ground to cover there,
yeah.
A lot of generalities. The one specific, I guess, that he did mention is the DNR magazine. And it isn't that the governor's going to cut the funding for it because the magazine, well, I suppose in a way he is, but the magazine is self-sufficient. It pays for itself. I think what he's planning on doing is just cutting whatever staff is left there and deleting the magazine. I'm hoping that that doesn't actually happen. I don't think it's going to. There's been an awful lot of support from the public for that publication, and the governor's been hearing a lot about it. I can guarantee you that. So I think that that one probably is going to, you know, the magazine's going to stay in place when the budget finally is fully completed. Research. One thing I wish I had a better handle on is where we have research going on in the state right now. I know there's a lot of it being done in the university system. I don't have a good handle on who's working on what at which campus. I wish I knew more about that. I know that they did cut some spots in the DNR. I've been told that they pulled different resources together within the agency so that they're trying to cover some of the ground that's lost with those cuts. But again, I don't have a good handle on exactly what's being done within the DNR. I wish I knew more about that. Maybe Pat or Tim do.
Tim, I was just going to comment from you. You had an interesting point about who actually formed the EPA.
Well, exactly. And this whole topic of budget cuts, we could be talking the whole rest of the day, both in the state and nationally, and the effects on natural resources, because it's really dismal. But it was interesting because my wife and I had a chance to take a trip out to California not too long ago. And one of the things we did, we like to visit the presidential museums and to libraries to learn. And you learn so much about the individual and the times, things that took place. So we were at the Richard Nixon Presidential Museum and Library in Yorba Linda, California. And here's this information. Richard Nixon is the one who approved and put in the Environmental Protection Agency, a Republican. He also signed the Clean Air Act. So here you've got, you know, our air, our trees, our resources, they're not Democrat, they're not Republican, they're there. And here this Republican put that in. And now we've got the Trump budget just waging war on the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, we need clean air, we need clean water. And to me, it's very hard to understand. And the same thing in this state, what Dean referred to there with the Natural Resources Magazine, which is funded by subscribers. And subscribers and people are saying, we want that magazine, and it puts out good information, and it doesn't make sense. And I think maybe later on we can talk about the forestry mill tax, which I'd like to echo also, but it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Pat, you want to chime in?
Yeah, the thing I like to tell people a lot, because one thing I do like about getting older is you do get a few more perspectives on things. And the reason people like Richard Nixon approved the EPA is because the public demanded it. You know, he wouldn't have done that on his own, and Trump wouldn't be trying this on his own if he didn't think he could get, you know, various people in the public to support it. And so when people, it's kind of almost pathetic sometimes when people write to people like myself and other communicators and think we can do something about it. We can provide information and we can report on stuff and get people's comments, but ultimately, in a democracy, you get what you deserve. If you don't get out there and vote for people, and I always say, you straighten them out or you vote them out. And if you don't do that part, well, that's how things happen. Clean water is no accident. Clean air is no accident. These are things that people like, whether it's Nixon, whether it's Gaylord Nelson pushing him, all these people in our past who put these things into practice for us, we're benefiting from that today. And we can't allow people in the current system who don't understand their own history undo all that. There's been a lot of great things we're benefiting from right now because of people in our past did their part. They did vote. They did let people know, you know, how they feel about these things. Because chances are they were experiencing firsthand the effects of bad water and bad air, so they did something about it. And now we have clean water and cleaner water, and now you see those signs in our state, like I wrote about last week, where we have, you know, even though we already had problems with manure leaking into people's drinking water in Kewaunee County, you know, going back quite a few years, we're letting more of these huge cattle feeding operations go in, and then wondering why we're having all these problems with clean water. Well, you know, again, people have got to get involved and do something about it. You can't depend on your politicians to do what's right for you unless you really push them.
Yeah, good thoughts. Angel and Matt, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Angel in Onalaska next. Angel, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. My question is on chronic wasting disease. Once we kill the deer and it goes to be tested, how long do we got to wait, and what do I do with the carcass? Do I turn it in to be processed and they pull it off on the side, or does it get refrigerated, and how long will it take? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling. Pat, do you have info on that?
Yeah. One thing Wisconsin is good at is we are good at testing, and we're testing pretty efficiently. I think last fall people were getting the results back in about a week. You know, week at the most, maybe a little bit more, but not much. I mean, it's pretty damn fast. Excuse my language there, but it's pretty fast. And so what is recommended you do is, you know, process your deer and freeze the meat and keep it, you know, separate from everything else until you get that test result back. And then and then from there you can make a decision. Now, if the animal does test positive, the state does provide the service of destroying the meat for you. You can turn it in and they'll destroy it. Typically now what people do is if it's processed by a meat processor, they take care of the bones and they dispose of them. And in most cases these days, you know, the deer, when you process it yourself, it ends up in a landfill. And so it's not not causing a problem there. I mean, I think we've kind of gotten through that lesser of two evils. You know, is better to, you know, leave the bones, you know, in the area where you killed the deer if possible. You know, have them disposed of properly there.
Let's go to Mark in Green Bay next. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. We got a new scourge here on the southern end of Green Bay. It's nighttime carp hunters that have airboat, Kleeglit, vehicles that are out there all night long. I've talked to DNR.
Oops.
That stop you from having really loud motors, but they said there's no regulations on how loud a prop can be. So you can shake the entire southern end of the bay here with a single boat moving every few seconds. It's like a small plane taking off. Neighbors are all mad about it, and I'm just wondering what you guys think about that technique, that method of taking carp.
Well, Dean Bortz, you want to take a crack?
Sure, you bet. I'm all for it. I love bow fishing for carp or any kind of rough fish. I understand the concerns that your caller called in with. The bow fishermen that I've been out with, I don't have any of my own equipment. Any time that I've done it, I've been able to jump in with somebody who has the gear and the boats. You know, they do have bright lights on them. The people that I've gone out with understand that. They try to avoid houses and shorelines with houses on them. None of the boats that I rode in were loud. They had four-stroke engines, and they had, you know, so when they were traveling, they were really very quiet, and they use electric trolling motors when they're moving around in the shallows to try to find the fish to shoot at. Most of them wrap up by midnight. I have never been out. I don't think I've ever, maybe till 1 a.m., but never all night. So I don't have a problem with it. I think it's a fun sport. It's a growing sport in Wisconsin. I imagine if there's something going on Green Bay, any law enforcement personnel are going to be aware of it, and they'll be working on it.
I think from some, when I was at one of the Natural Resources Board meetings, I know they were having some concerns down on the lower Wisconsin River with loud motor noises. And as I remember, that some of the wardens do have some of this sound testing equipment so that certain, especially the airboats, that they have to meet a certain minimum can't be over a maximum. So I think that would be worth checking with the local conservation warden to see if these are big airboats making lots of noise, if there are standards on that.
Yeah, it might be worth it for Mark to contact the local DNR enforcement officers, and if not, if they haven't been checking, they might well be interested in doing some checking. So that well worth it. Thanks for calling, Mark. I appreciate it. Bill in Beaver Dam, it's your turn now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. My question was pelicans.
Okay.
On Beaver Dam Lake.
Yeah. How
I'm 60 years old. I've never seen this before.
Yeah. They're probably white pelicans, which we had never seen white pelicans in Wisconsin for many, many years, but probably about 15 years ago, some of the first white pelicans were showing up in the state. And I think they were up around Green Bay and on the Mississippi River. And I had interviewed some of the biologists that they felt that there was something that happened out in the Dakotas and where the pelicans were used to be out there. And all of a sudden they shifted and some of them came into Wisconsin. And so the pelicans started coming into Wisconsin, and now we see them on many of the different water bodies. I see them all the time when duck hunting on the Mississippi River, and especially during the fall as they migrate. But I think they're in Green Bay, in the Mississippi, and in many of the different lakes. So they found a home here.
Yeah, interesting. Have any comments from Dean or Pat?
Well, I can echo Tim's a little bit. Fishing in the Fox River in Green Bay, we've seen them down there right around the paper mill dam quite a bit. I think Tim's right. It's some of the population shifted over, and they found Wisconsin a good place to land, and they just have kept coming back. So is it unusual? You know, for us, yes, but like Tim said, western states and Canadian provinces, pelicans have always migrated up there for the summer nesting and everything. So it's new to us, but not to the rest of the northern states or provinces.
Bill, thanks a lot for...
I was really curious.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. If you are curious about something, having a question about chronic wasting or maybe ticks or maybe some of the legislation, I know Tim wanted to talk about the forestry mill tax, and we'll address that as well. You may have some thoughts on it. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on the Larry Mealer Show Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. And let's go to Facebook for a minute here. John on Facebook says, as regards to CWD, I think everyone would feel more comfortable if we could be sure the game farms that test positive would be quarantined to be sure the herd can't escape into wild herds. And thoughts on that? And Pat, since you've been writing about it, and I know Dean probably, well, all three have been writing about it, but we'll start with Pat.
I know there's current legislation being proposed to double fence the game farms, and right now the ones that test positive, if in an ideal world we'd basically wipe out that herd and then forever seal its contents from the outside world. But I think the one thing that I think gets lost so often in Wisconsin is we want to make this whole issue right now about game farm, and I do believe we should have good, strict, uniform regulations governing this. But it's hard for me to get really dogmatic about game farms being the problem right now when we have literally thousands of deer running around the wild with chronic wasting disease. And until we really get serious about addressing that problem, I can see where these game farm people feel like, why are you picking on us when a lot of these people that are running these game farms, they're good business people, they're good people who are not causing a problem. And they have to deal with the fact that some of their members, colleague, did not do a good job and might very well have been the start of the whole thing. But, what happened 30, 40 years ago, we can't control that. All we can control is what we have right now. And right now we have a problem with CWD showing up along the Wisconsin Riverway and spreading up into the central counties. So to me, I think that's where I want to see more work being done.
Yeah. Dean, a comment from you?
Yeah, sure. I'd agree with everything Pat said there. I would be a little more focused on game farms, though, at least in making sure that something is done or something's in place to take care of any positives that come up. And Pat mentioned the legislation that's kind of being worked through the system now regarding the fencing, double fencing of any place at any farm that's found with positives. But I think we should probably be able to do something a little bit more quickly on depopulating game farms once they are found to be, where there's a positive in there. That sometimes takes a little while, and in the meantime, there have been escapes from places, from farms where positives have been found. That doesn't help. So if we could have something in place to act quickly on some of these situations, I think that would make people feel a lot better.
Yeah.
And that was also one of the recommendations of the CWD Response Committee when they met earlier this year. One of the things they asked for was to have enhanced fencing or double or electric fencing on facilities where they had a CWD servant. And I think that's part of the recommendation that Representative Milroy and his bill that is going through, that if they've got a positive, to have no reason that you don't have double fencing or an electric fence around there, because there's a potential of the wild herd coming in contact with the herd behind the fence, and who knows if there's other animals there that are CWD positive. So that's the danger, and they ought to have double fencing or electric fencing some way to keep them separate.
Tom in Brookfield has a question. Tom, hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning, guys. Great show. Hey, from what I know about chronic wasting is, I thought that started way out in the western states a long, long time ago. And all the talk about chronic wasting, is it a proven fact that it is harmful to humans?
Is it a proven fact that it's harmful to humans? Pat, you were commenting a little bit on that earlier, maybe.
Yeah, right now there's no evidence that CWD has ever, as they say, jumped the species barrier and caused a problem for humans. But again, there's no proof that way, but doesn't mean it won't happen in the future. And that's always going to be the big question. And you get back into all these different things we could be worrying about and testing on. And, like Tim mentioned earlier about this idea that, well, what if food that is being grown in these CWD contaminated areas is being consumed around, it's being shipped out, whether it's in a local farm market or wherever it might be. These are kind of concerns we should be asking. And I know, like my wife asks the question quite often, is when CWD was first really in people's minds, you'd walk into a sausage-making place, and they would always ask you and verify that this animal came from an area that's CWD-free. And if it wasn't from if it came from an area where you had CWD, well, then they recommend you go to a shop that, in that area that knows how to process that deer and handle that meat. Well, these days, how often do you get asked that? You don't get asked that very often. We've gotten really complacent in recent years about policing ourselves, having processing places police themselves. So it's to me, there's a lot of little risks there if you ever do have a health concern. There's a lot of people out there right now eating CWD tainted meat and don't even know it. It's something we should be talking about.
Thanks, Tom, for calling. Paul in Mequonigo, your turn next. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for the show. My question was, it's such a hard disease to really detect even in people that, to my knowledge, the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota was the only place in the United States that was testing and treating patients with CW, and they stopped that a couple of years ago. And the only reason why I know that is a lady that I stayed with her bed and breakfast up in Bayfield. Her husband got the disease. He was confused one day when he was fishing, and he went downhill pretty quick. And he went to the Mayo Clinic. They diagnosed it real quick, and she told me and gave me literature that he was the last group of people to be tested in the United States.
I'm not sure. Are you, Pat, are you familiar with that?
I have not heard that, no.
It's possible that it was...
I think he's got it mixed up with the other disease.
Yeah, something's not clicking there for me, but yeah. I can't say for certain.
I think the one...
CJD, I think, is it...
Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease.
I think he has it mixed up with CJD.
Right.
Because there is no test, nothing for CWD in humans that I know of, and I didn't know that anybody was testing that.
I think, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is something that has occurred and frankly, has taken a couple of my friends' lives, including one natural resources person here from the University of Wisconsin. But I think she may, when she talked to you, Paul, she may have been confusing CWD with CJD, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Because there, as far as I know, there's been no testing or no test for it among humans. Roland in Milwaukee, let's go to you next. Hi, Roland. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
And for putting the program together. I have a question about CWD and any research that's been done with wolves. A good buddy of mine told me that wolves apparently are immune to the saliva that deer are carrying around, and I know that wolves are a hot button issue, but I wonder, A, if there's research out there, and B, I guess if that conversation is even going on, is wolves being part of a solution to dealing with chronic waste disease and infected deer?
Oh. Well, let's turn to Dean Bortz for that. Dean?
There probably, again, there's no way to prove that CWD can't jump species, but I think that, well, I shouldn't say that we're safe to say that CWD isn't going to jump from deer to wolves, but probably is not. And so, yes, if you're wondering, if their caller is wondering if a wolf can eat a CWD-infected deer and not become infected with the disease, most likely. As far as wolves... helping in the fight against CWD, we first have to get wolves to exist in places where we have the heaviest concentration of CWD-infected deer. Right now, I don't think we've got a lot of wolves in Iowa County. So whether that's ever going to happen, I don't know. We'd have to start catching wolves and shipping them to southern Wisconsin. And having living in Vilas County, I can tell you there's a lot of folks where I live here that wouldn't mind seeing that happen, but I don't think that's a valid solution.
Yeah. And I think that was sort of a part of that new southwest Wisconsin deer study, because they're going to be looking at predators down there, and not so much wolves, but basically coyotes and bobcats. So they're trying to capture them, test them, and see just does the disease transfer from diseased deer into some of the predators? Because right now, my understanding is it has not, but I don't think they know a lot, and that's going to be part of this new deer study in southwest Wisconsin.
Oh, interesting.
I think too, Larry, there was a recommendation or some research out in Montana about wolves and CWD, and they don't have CWD in Montana, at least not that we know of. But I guess part of the thinking is that if there is a decent number of wolves around, and it's like the most diseases, an animal starts getting weakened with various elements before they're even showing outward signs of the disease. So that the idea is that if wolves are present in enough numbers, and an animal is starting to get sick from CWD and it's in the early stages, chances are it's not as elusive anymore. It's losing some of its awareness, where it's not as alert anymore. So chances are they'll get picked off earlier in the process now than they currently would be, and therefore along down the road, that mean they'd be off the landscape sooner, which means they're not going to be spreading around the CWD prions when they defecate and urinate and groom each other, those kind of things. So there is, in theory, it sounds like it might be something worth considering. But again, like Dean said, I don't foresee the day where we're going to have enough wolves running around southern Wisconsin where it's going to be ever be a real realistic solution.
Yeah, they might play a bigger role if CWD, or maybe even say when CWD makes it to northern Wisconsin.
Right.
Yeah. We're talking today with Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer, as we talk about natural resource issues here in the state of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for being with us today as we take a look at natural resource issue with Dean Bortz, Pat Durkin, and Tim Isley, all outdoor communicators. It's wonderful to have them along. And certainly if you have questions, you can call at 800-642-1234, shoot us an email at ideas@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Doug in Prairie du Chien has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Doug.
Hey, I have first I want to say I'm in favor of bringing eagles back. You know, I'm protecting them. But I got a concern about the Lower Wisconsin River Board is bringing up an issue with high-powered deer rifle bullets shattering and the eagles getting a hold of a carcass and dying from the lead poisoning. But my concern is that the eagle numbers are overly inflated artificially, and I was just concerning if these numbers and these studies wouldn't be used to ban high-powered rifles in favor of shotguns or, you know, some other type of weapon to use for deer.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's turn to Tim Isley first. Tim?
Well, thanks, Larry, and thanks, Doug, for calling. I guess I would say that I've had the opportunity to watch two different demonstrations. One here in Wisconsin when Carl Batha, who is a retired wildlife biologist with the Department of Natural Resources, another one was out west. There was an organization out there that did the same thing where they put up milk jugs, plastic milk jugs, put about 10 of them in a line, and they shoot into that with a high-powered deer rifle. And then they take that apart, and you take a look in where the rifle bullet stops in there, and then they look, and you see all the fragments that are there. So lead bullets do fragment, and it can be both in your venison, in the meat, as well as, it, of course, can get lodged into the innards that then a deer hunter discards. I'm an avid hunter. I do everything because I hunt. That's the reason that I got into doing what I do in outdoor writing. And I just feel as a hunter, if I have some impact on especially non-game animals or other ones, that then I need to take ownership of that. So when I my 30-06, I buy non-toxic bullets for that rifle. And my shotgun, I will not buy any more lead shot for that. I will buy non-toxic shot. That's what I believe. But I think hunters just need to realize that this does happen. There may be things that you can do if you're discarding the innards of a deer and trying to make it so that eagles don't find what you leave, the gut pile in the woods, so that there is a problem, I think, when eagles feed on that. And it's a terrible death. I've seen the Raptor Education Center up in Antigo and how they've treated eagles that have been sick. And it's a wonderful success story that they've come back. And so I would just say we need to be aware of what lead can do and make every effort we can to reduce that.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. So your advice is there's other options to
that. Yes, there are non-toxic toxic rifle bullets and also obviously non-toxic shot for shotguns, either for upland game, for pheasants, for doves, for turkeys. For geese and ducks, obviously waterfowl, you have to use non-toxic shot. But that was something that Wisconsin was a leader in back in the 1970s when they called it iron shot back then. But then actually it became steel shot. And now there's bismuth and there's many other different types of shots. So there's a lot of alternatives that are available now.
Yeah. Thanks, Doug, for calling. Madeline in De Pere, it's your turn. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. My feeling is that a lot of the decisions are made by the politicians and the management people. It's made for short-term financial gain, and they don't think about the long term. And also, I have a relative who lived in Upper Michigan who actually died from chronic wasting disease. He ate a real lot of wild game. And his wife had to force an autopsy of his brain, and then she had to force them to put it on his death certificate, and then they only wrote possible. And
All right. Well, comments on that, again, I have not. Well, Pat Durkin, you want to comment?
Yeah. I think I've actually read about that case, and what she's referring to, again, is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is, you know, present in the population. It's not. It's extremely rare. I think it's like 1 in 1,000,000 or something. It's really a very low number. But it's not something we should dismiss, and I don't think anyone is dismissing Creutzfeldt-Jakob as a cause of death. But I'm guessing too, it's not something that is always immediately apparent. It might take some extra testing. It's not something I know a whole lot about, and so I don't know what more we can do right now other than to keep, you know, testing this kind of stuff and seeing, you know, as best we know. Trying to figure out how this happens, but right now I don't think they even know how Creutzfeldt-Jakob shows up in people, because I know one guy who fairly famous guy who died of it was Tom Mulhern, a sports writer, and excellent guy, and died at a pretty young age. I think he was in his 40s when he died. And I mean, so when people, I don't like when people say, well, it's only a small number of people dying from this. I think, well, tell that to their family. You know, this is something we should know more about, learn more about, and I do hope we keep pushing that way.
Thanks very much. And I think that's really because of the initials, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease was CJD versus the other. It's easy, I think, to get those
right
confused. Let's go to Mike in Boulder Junction. Mike, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Great show. See, my only comment, I had two of them. One was on, you know, with these issues with the wolves up here. I'm in Vilas County, and I think wolves certainly help prevent disease spreading, but you know, we've got all this baiting and feeding up here that's just basically rampant, and that's obviously spreading disease and probably CWD, but you know, I worked, I'm a retired game warden from central Wisconsin, and I dealt a lot with deer farms, and there's a lot of issues with deer farms that aren't very transparent with this administration, and people are not being told all the facts on this. And with all due respect, I mean, these news writers, some that I have a great deal of respect for, you know, they aren't experts on a lot of these issues they're talking about, but, you know, try to get somebody from the DNR, they're not allowed to go out and talk to the public about CWD. And I think that needs to be mentioned.
Let's, Dean Bortz, that's Mike's hailing from your neck of the woods, so let's go to you.
All right. I got a feeling I know who Mike is, but that's fine. I'll talk to him about some of the stuff off the air later on, too. But, he's right. There, the deer farm issues, there are a lot of things out there that are happening and that the general public doesn't hear a lot about, and you know, there's some stuff that we're going to be working on here in the next couple of weeks on that I just learned about a couple of days ago in Douglas County, and I can't go too far into that right now, but it actually doesn't have anything to do with deer, different species, but yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on out there, and Mike's right. You know, for instance, as far as the DNR not being able to say anything, you know, you look at some of our legislative hearings in the past. If you had a DNR expert, biologist, fisheries or wildlife, and they were called into a hearing, they were allowed to give their view on their research or their work and how it might the proposed bill might be affected by what they, you know or learned out of the field. Nowadays, they can't testify. Like, they'll appear at a hearing, but they can only testify for information. They can't pass along their opinion. If I call somebody from the DNR on a story, you know, there's a lot of clearance that they need to jump through, hoops they have to clear in order to talk to me or any reporter. So, yeah, there's a
a lot going on there that, you know, in other days gone by, you know, things were a lot different. I'm trying to remember what else Mike talked about there that I was able to touch on, but I can't remember some of his other topics. Larry, can you give me?
I think Tim's going to jump in here.
Well, I was just going to back Dean up on this fact that the DNR used to come in and take a stand on proposed legislation, and they're the steward for natural resources in this state, and they no longer are allowed to. The secretary won't allow them to take a stand on it, and I think that is questionable, certainly in my mind. But also the feeding and baiting issue, when the CWD Response Committee, they had their meetings earlier this year, and one of their recommendations was to request legislation for a statewide ban on baiting and feeding of wild cervids to reduce the risk of disease transmission. And the problem is that that has to go through the legislature. So hopefully that will come.
Yeah. And Dean Bortz, I know you have to leave. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, Dean.
You bet, Larry. Happy to be here. The one other thing I'll just mention quickly that I do remember Mike talking about was the baiting and feeding ban. The people are baiting and feeding in Vilas County. Well, they really shouldn't be, because there is a ban right now in place in Vilas, Oneida.
In Oneida counties, yeah. Well, our other two guests are going to be staying with us, so you stay with us too. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at natural resource issues with two guests now. Patrick Durkin, a freelance writer, editor, and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. We've talked a lot about CWD, and we may move our conversation off that a little bit and deal with some other issues that are pretty important to the people here in the state. You have a question or comment, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Tim Isley, I'm going to turn back to you, because we've had several callers that weren't able to hang on, plus a very long email from, and all these people were concerned about the governor's proposed budget for eliminating the forestry mill tax and replacing it with general purpose revenues. And I know this is something that you have done some thinking about. Talk about the possible implications of that.
Right, Larry. I think this is really an important issue, and unfortunately a lot of people don't know about it. What the governor did was to slip this into the budget to eliminate the forestry mill tax and replace it with GPR, general purpose revenues, which basically are our state taxes, our sales tax, and our income taxes. So the forestry mill tax is a small tax which is on real property. So it's on your house, it's on my house, it's on all the houses that people own, and it's really relatively small. For the average house, I think it's been estimated to be like about $25 to $27 a year. What that does is that funds a large part of our forestry program in the state of Wisconsin. I think the forestry budget during a recent year was something like $108 million, and it was about $83 million that came from the forestry mill tax. Now, that forestry mill tax then funds our state forestry operations, and also there's about $13 million of that that goes in to fund the debt on the stewardship program. It's really important for forestry. And the problem is, the governor said, okay, it's going to be, he'll fund it equally with GPR funds in this budget. All right, fine. If that's what makes it through the budget committees and everything, there's no major difference. The problem is, in the future, what's the next legislature and the next legislature and the next governor going to do? They are most likely, right now they're looking at, how do we fund our schools? How do we fund our roads and fix the potholes in our roads? So then this is going to be in the GPR fund, and they're going to have to fund forestry out of that. And my hunch is forestry is going to be low down the list. And all of us, I mean, we live in houses that have 2x4s, probably timbers in the houses. We go to state forest, we recreate there. The other forester land that is bought with stewardship money, and the debt is paid on that, and all the products that come from forestry is really important to this state and to the economy. And I think it really, it's a dedicated funding source that we have now. And why lose it? It doesn't make sense. And I don't know of a single woodland or forest organization in this state that has come out in support of it. And in fact, just recently, the Wisconsin Council on Forestry took a vote, and they basically were against this proposal. And all the other, the woodland owners and other woodland associations and consulting foresters, it doesn't make any sense. Why change something that right now is doing good work? And it doesn't make sense. But people have got to know, because when this goes to the Joint Finance Committee, it could go through unless they hear from people who are concerned about it. It's doing a lot of good. It's a specific thing right now for a specific purpose. If they've got problems, some of the people who have got problems with how the forestry money is used, then come up with an audit. Audit the forestry fund and see where it's being spent. Some of the legislators don't like where it's being spent. All right, audit where it's being spent. But don't kill the goose that is funding this the forestry ag in the state.
Yeah. Pat, a comment from you?
Yeah, the thing that I think gets lost so often with some folks with forestry discussions is that forestry, in terms of it needs long-term management. It needs programs that live beyond our lifetime. And so that's one of the beauties of this forestry mill tax. It was created about 90 years ago, again, by our forefathers and foremothers, however you want to call them, who understood that forestry is a long-term process, and funding for it has to be stable. You can't just go from lurch along like we do with budget to budget. It also brings up the whole issue of why are we having these kind of items come up in a biannual budget? You know, these are real serious policy discussions we're having about this, and they're coming up as a budget item, which is not doing, in this case, the mill tax. It's not showing it due respect for what it's been doing for Wisconsin for the past almost 100 years.
Yeah. Let's take some more calls here. Ann in Green Bay, we'll turn to you next. Thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. And I'm not real clear of the facts on this, but I'm hoping that the two of you might know something about. The state is apparently talking about selling state lands to the DNR and then inflating the prices and then basically stealing that money from the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund to do this. And if that's something you're familiar with, I hope you'd educate us a little bit on that, because I'm a little uneducated on that myself. So,
all right. Thanks for calling. Pat, do you want to start on that, Pat Durkin?
I was actually hoping you'd defer to Tim, but because this is one of these issues where I'm reading this, and I'm like your caller. I read that, and I'm thinking, now what kind of creative mind came up with that idea? Because I just don't understand how that's going to work. I mean, especially when you think we've been cutting pretty consistently for the last, you know, several years. We've been cutting on the stewardship funding, and now we're talking about doing this to me convoluted sales stuff. I don't get it. So I guess I just defer to Tim, because I really don't know how that's going to work, and I'm real skeptical that it would provide any kind of long term source of funding.
No. Yeah, I think I'm not familiar with the exact what the caller was saying there, but what happened was that in the previous budget, of course, the legislature directed the department to sell, I think it was 10,000 acres of land that was outside of state boundaries. So the DNR had to go through and look at all of the public lands and look, and sometimes they get land that's donated to them, and there's land that's outside of a designated boundary. So the DNR went through and they looked at all of these properties, and they came up with properties that were the if anything was questionable, the best ones to sell. And I know even the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation really complimented the DNR on the job that they did, where they picked these lands that had to be sold according to the legislature, or put up for sale according to the legislature, and they did that. Now, I don't know if that's going to be coming back in another budget, but I know the recent proposal, which I've heard, has been because there have been some that have evidently have a feud with the Board of Commissioners on Public Lands, and of course, Tia Nelson used to be the secretary, and she was basically a Democrat, and she resigned. What they wanted to do was to take some of this land that the Board of Commissioners on Public Lands owns and holds for the state, and they wanted to sell that, and I think they wanted to put some of the money for sale in that into some scholarships at the university. They're trying to say, hey, this is a good thing because it's going to the university. The concern is you're getting rid of public land, and they're not making any more land anymore. So any efforts to get rid of public land, and we see this nationally with national monuments now and national parks where some of the Congress people want to sell that and turn it over into private hands. Boy, we enjoy public lands right now, and we're lucky because people in the past had the foresight to create these lands, and it seems to me it's foolish to sell them at this point.
Let's turn to Jim in Stoughton next. Thank you for waiting, Jim. Hello.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Bear hunting, training of bear hunting dogs. Now, I read where at one time there was a licensing fee for out-of-state dog trainers, and that was eliminated. And now the deaths by wolf predation on these hunting dogs has gone up like tenfold because an increase of these hunters bringing them in from out of other states, because Wisconsin is one of the few states that allows the training of bear dogs. Is that true?
Pat Durkin, you want to take a try at that?
Yeah, I can't see what all other states have for this. But yeah, our laws on dog training for bear hunting are pretty liberal. And yeah, we do get quite a few people coming in from other states, you know, to train their hunting dogs. And we get into this every year with, you know, dogs being killed during the training season. That's primarily when dogs do get killed by wolves. You know, that, you know, the thinking is that these hounds run through an area where the wolves are raising their young, and the wolves are especially protective in that time of year, like in July, August time period. And then once you actually get into the hunting season, you see a pretty good drop off in the number of bear hounds being killed by wolves. It does drop off. But as far as all the cause and effect of why bear hounds die faster or you get killed more often during the summer by these hounds and by the wolves, God, it you really get some interesting discussions there. I guess to me that the one thing I can always talk to is that the idea that we'd compensate people for their losing their dog to a wolf is kind of an idea that goes back quite a few years, where they thought, well, if it helps people accept the loss, where, you know, it keeps the wolves protected that much more, you work with these guys and they lose their animals, but you compensate them for the loss, acknowledge the fact that they'd lost something because of this. You know, that's an important criteria for some people. But I think right now, I often get back to this discussion of why are we paying people things for things that wildlife do? We can't possibly compensate everything, whether it's crop damage, whether it's losses to wolves. I think it's just one of these programs that we establish, and then basically we get trapped by it. We never get out of it. It goes on for, you know, it's very hard to stop those kind of programs once they get started. So I guess if I were king, I'd just eliminate all these different compensation programs and make people deal with these things, you know, much more upfront. So I guess I'll stop there.
All right.
I would certainly back what Pat has said there, but I think that this year now the Department of Natural Resources is planning to review the bear management plan, the long-range bear management plan. And I think that one of the things that they're going to be looking at are some of these problems with bears as far as some areas where they have had some problems with bears being a nuisance and causing some damage, but also the conflict between where people are running, training their dogs for bears, and then coming into problems with wolves because of the conflict, you know, when they have to train them and when the wolves might be having rendezvous sites at their dens. So these are things that I think that are going to be talked about and will be talked about during this coming year and will come up for public discussion. And I think will be built in, any changes would be built into the DNR bear management plan.
Tim, I want to go back to you for a minute because there are several trips or outings that people can take advantage of. And I know you wanted to mention some of those because they offer some really good family opportunities.
Great. Yes, thank you, Larry. The Natural Resources Foundation, which is a nonprofit here in the state of Wisconsin, they do all sorts of good things. They raise money for natural resources, and they give grants, and they have endowments. They do many, many good things. They're just a great group. But one of the unique things they do are these field trips, and they have over 200 field trips that are going throughout the state of Wisconsin this summer and even into the fall. Many are led by DNR biologists, but others are led by naturalists and by volunteers. And they go out, especially to some of the state natural areas in all over the state. And it's a great way to learn. But I checked with them, and people sign up for those. In fact, they sign up for them in March, and usually sometimes a lot of them fill up right away. But as of this past week, there were still 700 spaces available on about 100 trips around the state. One of them was to Quincy Bluff and some Barrens restoration up there. Another one was on a limnology panel in the Waupaca Channel Lakes in June. There's a children's John Muir Saunter in June up in Marquette County, where people get to walk where John Muir was. There's some other ones in the Chippewa River, the West Fork Paddle, and there's two of them on the Mississippi River, pontoon boat there, and then a waterfowl ID in October in La Crosse. So they still have openings for these, and they're great for taking out families, for going out and learning. I mean, you know, it's all about lifelong learning, and that's what the Natural Resources Foundation does, is help people come in contact with wildlife and natural resources. And I just like to mention that there still are some trips that are available. And it's a nonprofit, and it's a very small cost to take these, and you really learn, and they're still available.
I've been on some of those trips. They're really a lot of fun, that's for sure.
And they're an excellent resource.
Yeah, they really are. There are some sporting groups I've heard that are actually asking for DNR fee increases. Tim, I think you had a comment on that.
Yes. Earlier this year, there were 14 Wisconsin conservation groups, because there's about a $4 million shortfall in what's called a fish and wildlife account, which basically that's what pays for our fish management, our wildlife management, our conservation programs in the state. These are through licenses, hunting, fishing, trapping licenses. There's about a $4 million gap. And basically, they came up with some recommendations on increasing, like, the bear tag application from $4 to $10, the state waterfowl stamp from $7 to $12, Great Lakes salmon trout stamp from $10 to $15. They're targeted proposals. And there's all these groups, Ducks Unlimited, Rough Grouse Society, Quality Deer Management, National Wild Turkey Federation, Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. So basically, these are people who pay the fees, and they're saying, hey, we are willing to pay more. And because there's a shortfall in the fish and wildlife account, and it's not in the governor's budget proposal. So right now it'd be flat and there'd be this shortfall. So what are you going to do? You're going to basically reduce our fish and wildlife management or the enforcement. So they're asking for a tax themselves. So hopefully, if the Joint Finance Committee hears that, if legislators hear it, these are people asking, we want to pay more ourselves. And people hopefully know about that and will support that.
Yeah. Pat, any comment from you?
Yeah, the one thing I will always say for our conservation community, the hunters, fishers, trappers, we've always been willing to pay, and we pay a lot of money through federal excise taxes on archery equipment, on firearms, on ammo, because we understand that this isn't just paying; we're actually investing in something, and these are, you know, long-term investments. And some of the things Tim mentioned about, you know, these shortfalls in the state budget, sometimes, you know, we act like we can always discount our way to prosperity. And the one thing we did recently in the legislature, they discounted all these hunting license fees for young beginning hunters, and then for people who are their mentors. And, you know, I ran some numbers on that, and it showed we're losing, you know, literally millions of dollars every year in these discounts. And typically, the people taking advantage of it, they would still buy these licenses anyway. So we never even showed that we really needed to discount these things in order to produce sales. And now that we've done it a few years, we're seeing it's not generating new sales. It's basically the same people who would be buying them anyway. So we sometimes jump into these things without really doing the proper homework to see if it would really achieve what we want. And so that's one thing that we could identify right away, just restore the full price of these things to start with. We get a lot of money back that way.
Well, there's a whole lot more that we can talk about here, and we've got a couple of minutes left. I know one person wanted to know how to take action on the mill tax.
I think number one, they should contact their own legislator, the senator and representative, and then I think they would contact the Joint Finance Committee. All the people, those names are all on a website, and they should contact them and ask them, "Hey, this is important stuff, and we'd like to not see a change on that."
And back to you, Pat. Is we just kind of, what's your take, just kind of overall on our situation? What are the most critical things in your mind in the natural resources area? It's a big question.
To me, a lot of it right now is the whole idea of an open, transparent DNR. It's gotten to be much more trying to control their message, and what's happening, they're really choking things off as far as information. You saw it in this attempt to get rid of the Natural Resources magazine, for one. And like earlier, the caller from the retired game warden said that you know, Tim and I and Dean, he points out that we are not the experts. And I think Tim, Dean, and I all agree, we are not the experts. We're reporters, basically. And no reporter will ever have the expertise, firsthand expertise, that a guy or woman who comes up through the ranks and understands natural resources. They spend their college careers in natural resource management. They learn all these things, and we can tap into them and tap into the expertise and quote them and write about things they tell us, but we'll never be experts in those areas. That's why I think it's really important for the DNR to have people readily accessible to lawmakers to testify without needing, you know, like right now, the only way they can testify is if a legislator requests their presence. And in the past, the DNR basically would have meetings beforehand saying, okay, this bill's up for hearing today. We want you, next week, we need you to go down there and testify and give a scientific, response to this. Well, we don't do that anymore. The DNR today does not do that. They have to be summoned, and then they go carefully choose who they want to have go down and testify, and then they basically figure out what they want to say. And it's just really they're no longer representing the public, and they are stewards by law to be, the watchdogs of our natural resources, and they're not being allowed to do their job.
And in 15 seconds, a comment from you, Tim?
Very much agree. We've got to go back to where the Natural Resources Board selects the secretary. Those were the good years. And we need funding for non-game animals, because right now, the licenses are paying this, and some of the DNR wildlife people are only able to manage game species. We need funding for non-game. We've got to come up with a way to put money into non-game wildlife.
Well, guys, I want to thank you so much. Pat Durkin, thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much. And Tim Isley, to you as well.
Thank you, Larry.
So Pat Durkin, a freelance writer, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Tim Isley, full-time freelance outdoor writer and photographer. And we have them come on every 3-4 months and talk about what's going on, what they're hearing from their constituents, and what they're learning as they write about these issues. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store.